And you're listening to The Science Show on RN, coming from Vancouver in Canada and the big AAAS meeting there, which was riven with concern about the bird flu virus designed by scientists to be even more deadly through being carried in the air. Here's Laurie Garrett on the Health Report.
It's a virus that's known as H5N1, popularly known as bird flu. It's a mysterious virus because, as far as we know, it first surfaced in China in the mid-1990s, didn't really rear its ugly head publicly until 97 in Hong Kong, and didn't really start to spread much until 2003 after it had undergone a natural mutation. Overall, it's a terrible virus for birds. And when it hits certain kinds of flocks, like chickens, it kills practically every single bird. In rare circumstances, human beings have contracted the virus, and it has, as far as we know, very rarely spread from one human being to another. But for the human beings that have contracted it, the mortality rate has been terrifying. I mean, it's up there in the level of mortality that we would see with the Ebola virus. You know, over the whole cumulative time since 97, of publicly acknowledged cases, it's killed just over 60%, 60. In Indonesia, the death rate's much higher. It's closer to 83%. And if you compare this to the single greatest pandemic that humanity has ever faced in known history, the 1918 flu pandemic, which killed somewhere between 80 and 100 million human beings on planet Earth in basically 18 months' time, that had a 2% mortality rate. Nasty, nasty, and a lot of money and energy has been spent killing off infected birds and trying to control the spread of H5N1, you know, as a veterinary task, if you will, mostly in poor countries where it circulates widely, in China, in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, in Egypt, in Nigeria, and so on. But all along, the debate has been, will this ever, in practical terms, be a threat to human beings?
That was Laurie Garrett, author of The Coming Plague, which got her a Pulitzer Prize. She was on the Health Report. So why would scientists want to make an even more deadly strain of bird flu, one carried in the air? And should that research, including details of how to make the killer germ, be published? Well, the World Health Organization this week seemed to say yes. Here's the editor of the journal Science, published by AAAS, Dr. Bruce Alberts, on the issues.
When you do leave something out because you think that it could be misused in a serious way by people who want to do harm, then how do you get the information that people are trying to protect us need from that scientific research? So the background is that the U.S. government recognizes that this is an international issue, especially so because the place where the greatest danger is, initially at least, is in those areas where so-called bird flu is endemic and where many people have caught the virus and, in fact, died from flu that they caught directly from birds. So the United States government initially thought that they could bring WHO and the international community in through their own mechanisms, but my understanding right now is that it's now considered that this will have to be overseen more directly by the WHO, that is the World Health Organization in Geneva, which has a major flu network already and which does have very great activity in all the endemic areas.
It's very interesting that the AAAS meeting a few years ago, there was in fact an entire session based on whether you should keep science secret when it was possibly going to be used by terrorists or whether it had some sort of general danger. Was that outline not sufficient to get a protocol going?
In fact, you know, after 9/11, there was a great stirring in the United States to try to get ahead of these problems. And in fact, the National Academy of Sciences, I was then the president of the National Academy, was asked to do a study on what we should do going forward about biotechnology information in an age of terrorism, because we only realized it was an age of terrorism after 9/11. And that study, which contained at least 7 Academy members, plus people who were living in the world of security, produced a very important report which led to the setting up of the NSABB. And the NSABB, that is this organization that has now decided for the first time that not everything should be public. This report from the Academy, called the Fink Report, because Jerry Fink, a distinguished scientist at MIT, was a chair, did foresee that there would be a time when we'd have to make such decisions. And they said that they recommended a mechanism that is now being carried out, which heavily involves expert scientists. The problem before there was such a thing as the NSABB was that these decisions were being made by people who didn't really understand the science. And when that happens, there tends to be an overreaction on the side of secrecy. And in fact, the NSABB has, since its existence, its first meeting was in 2005, so it's now more than 6 years. In its existence, this is the first time they have decided on the side of keeping part of the information secret to the public, but to provide it selectively to those with a need to know.
How is it possible, then, do you think, among scientists who leak like crazy, to keep something like that contained?
Yes.
When it could so easily just one eruption on one website and bingo?
That's true. I mean, I've been told by many journalists that if it gets to more than 100 scientists, they're sure they could get it in 2 weeks. I don't know whether that's true or not. Of course, the information will not be provided in electronic form, which, you know, in electronic form, it just could go everywhere. But nevertheless, the point is well taken. And this has to be an important part of the consideration when the WHO and international authorities and the U.S. government are trying to decide who has the need to know and how many people like that are there. I should point out that their technologies, I mean, I would like this occasion to sort of a wake-up call in two ways. One is we now realize, because of this science, that this virus, which mutates in the wild all the time, can very easily mutate to a form, which is surprisingly easy, that's the main lesson, that they can survive in air and spread from bird to bird or from person to person and cause the pandemic. The virus in its current form, although it's highly lethal when people get infected, does not spread really from human to human in the air, so it's not nearly as dangerous as it would be if it did. So this is a big issue now that's facing us, is how we're going to try to protect the world from this real possibility and give the information to the people with a need to know so that they can protect us and yet not make the whole world know how to design a very lethal virus. I think there are some technological things that could be done. For example, I've been arguing with the U.S. government, this is a great opportunity to provide the latest technologies, automatic machines for screening for mutations in these virus. You know, the U.S. government could support a process which gets those machines in Indonesia, in Vietnam, in places with this problem. And at least some of these machines, you know, people could operate them. The information could be reported out in a form that doesn't actually expose to the person using the machine directly which mutations have been found, only to a select group, who then know how to decode that information. So there are opportunities, technological opportunities, to protect us without getting the information to thousands of scientists, which I think would make it certain to leak.
When the scientists who need to know have got what they require to do experiments themselves, what will be the purpose of their experiments? To see how they can combat this particular lethal kind of virus?
There are at least two different aspects here. One is as a screening mechanism to see when and what bird flocks the virus is getting close, you know, one or two mutations away from being able to be aerosolized. And that's the kind of protection that I've been talking about so far. The other kind of issue is try to understand, you know, what is it that makes the difference between a flu virus that can survive in air and one that cannot? Of course, that could start by working with not-so-dangerous viruses, but also, given the mutations that we now know can be dangerous, is there some way to make a better vaccine, either against the altered viral proteins that correspond to those mutations, which, of course, the scientist has to know what they are, or, in fact, to make a much more effective vaccine than we have today. We're still making vaccine to flu in eggs. There are modern recombinant DNA methods. A lot of research in trying to design better vaccines. But my understanding is that up to now there hasn't really been the incentive to actually put the resources in to develop such vaccines. And so perhaps a good outcome of this occasion in the long run is, first of all, that humans will be sure to get a flu vaccine shot. So many people don't want to do that. And secondly, that our vaccines will become much better so they can protect us not only from the common flu, but from many other kinds of varieties, such as H5N1, that may arise in nature.
Finally, as an editor of a great science journal, the most read one in the world, perhaps, do you feel instinctively that freedom of the press, people should know?
So my bias, of course, is on that side. Not only a freedom of the press, but freedom of science. And in fact, we had a situation when I was president of the Academy where I had to decide to publish a paper on botulinum toxin in milk supply, 2005. This is before there was an NSABB, so there was no authority to go to. But we were being pressured by people from our government not to publish it. And in fact, we decided to publish it, and I wrote an editorial why. So the fact is that when information is public, scientists everywhere could work to develop better protection agents, and you don't even know, who those scientists might be. So this was the same attitude of the Fink Committee that wrote the report for the Academy, but nevertheless, they did outline seven different kinds of conditions where the opposite kind of decision might need to be made. And they did point out that an absolute rule that always everything should be published was not the way to approach the future, but we hope that these kinds of occasions will be very rare.
Dr. Bruce Alberts is editor-in-chief of the journal Science, which may well soon now publish the bird flu papers. WHO seems inclined to back this. Published in full, and the journal Nature concurs.